We'll take a closer look at Matthew 24 today. We'll talk about the rising tide of anti-Semitism and look at the elections in Israel. All that and more on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. I'm blessed and delighted to be with you. The phone lines are open for all Jewish-related questions. They can be Hebrew questions, questions about Messianic prophecy, specific Old Testament-related questions, questions about Israel today, questions about the Jewish people, Jewish tradition. Phone lines are open, 866-348-7884. If you just stumbled on the broadcast and wonder who I am a Jewish follower of Jesus. He is my Lord and Savior and Messiah and King, and it's my joyful privilege to make him known to Jew and Gentile alike. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. We've got a lot to cover, a really helpful article by a friend and colleague in Israel about the Israeli elections. I want to read much of it to you later. I want to share some of the most recent, wild, over-the-top, crazy comments that I received in response to my video dealing with anti-Semitic comments by comedian Owen Benjamin. And yes, there is a Catholic scholar, E. Michael Jones, who I believe has been a source of information for Owen Benjamin, and we do want to have him on the air. I saw someone on YouTube saying he wants to come on. In any case, I think he's the kind of guy that would gladly do it, and we'll have a very candid dialogue about issues that we differ on very strongly. So looking forward to doing that. I can't speak for him yet, but I believe that's going to happen, and we look forward to that as well. We'll also talk on the show today about the question, can you criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic? Can you criticize Jews without being anti-Semitic? We'll talk about that as well. But first, let's take a look at Matthew 24. Matthew 24 is a key passage for the end times. It is called the Olivet Discourse because Yeshua, Jesus, spoke it on the Mount of Olives. And we have parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21 with the same information laid out a little differently and here and there with a verse that the other won't have. But all three known as the Olivet Discourse. Now, those who hold to a pre-trib rapture believe that Matthew 24 speaks of two different events as far as the end times. Obviously, it speaks of the destruction of Jerusalem in Jesus' day, but then there's the belief it speaks of a final destruction, a final attack at the end of the age. And in particular, the thing we're going to focus on now is that it speaks of a rapture and a second coming. Those who hold to this theology would say that Jesus is speaking to the Jews in Matthew 24, or that Matthew as a whole is speaking to the Jews and it's for the Jews, not the church. However, there's obviously a rapture passage that must be for the church. What I want to look at is this. We're going to go through Matthew 24, and I'm just going to read it through and make some comments. What I want to point out is this. We're not going to get into a lengthy discussion of what applies to Jerusalem and that generation, the Jerusalem that was then destroyed 40 years after the time of Jesus, versus what applies just to the end of the age. We're not going to go back and forth on that. It's a whole other subject, and it's a worthy subject. All I want to do is this. I want to demonstrate that Jesus is speaking to one and the same audience the whole way through. In other words, whether it's his disciples, his believing disciples then, or he's believing disciples through the ages, or his believing disciples at the end of the age. In other words, you cannot make a distinction between this is for Israel, this is for the church. Some have attacked my post-trib position saying you don't understand Matthew 24, it's all for Israel. You don't understand Matthew as a whole, it's all for Israel. Some hold to that. Well, if it's all for Israel, then why is there a rapture passage in that? Because according to a pre-trib teaching, that is for the church. All right, so let's take a look at Matthew 24. Then when you and reading from the Tree of Life version. Then when Yeshua went out and was going away from the temple, his disciples came up to point out to him the temple buildings. "Don't you see all these?" he responded to them. "Amen, I tell you, not one stone will be left here on top of another. Every one will be torn down." As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" They thought that the destruction of the temple and the end of the age and his coming would all be one and the same event. But they ask him three questions or two questions with two a subdivision, so three possible, right? When will this happen? That's one. What will be the sign of your coming? Two. And the end of the age is three. In their mind, it's all one event, all right? So he's going to answer things that pertain to that generation and the final generation, all weaved together. Yeshua answered them, "Be careful that no one leads you astray." Who's he talking to? His disciples, his believers, those who are called part of the ecclesia, part of the church. They are believers. "For many will come in my name saying, 'I am the Messiah,' and will lead many astray. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not alarmed, for this must happen, but it's not yet the end. For nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. But all these things are only the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will hand you over to persecution and will kill you." Who? His disciples. "You will be hated by all the nations because of my name." Who? His disciples, his followers. All right. "And then many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. Because lawlessness will multiply, the love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. This good news of the kingdom shall be proclaimed in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come." His gospel is frequently called the good news of the kingdom. So, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. Now, this actually happened. According to ancient church records, we have that the Jewish believers in Yeshua, because of his warning, when they saw what was coming with the Roman armies, etc., they fled to Pella, which would be in Jordan today. They fled. So he's speaking to his disciples here, his believers, right? "The one on the roof must not go down to take what is in his house, and the one in the field must not turn back to get his coat. Woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days. Pray that your escape will not happen in winter or on Shabbat." Why? Because it's going to be more difficult to travel at that time and to get away. Now, you may say, well, this applies primarily to the end of the age. There's just an earlier parallel. Either way, I see a both and. I see applicable to that generation and the final generation. But my only point I want to emphasize is he's speaking to his believing people, all right? Born again believers who are going to bear reproach for his name. Not just the Jewish nation as a whole, but his born again people who are part of the ecclesia, part of the messianic body, part of the church. "For then there will be great trouble, such as not happened since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. And unless those days were cut short, no one would be delivered. But for the sake of the chosen, those days will be cut short." "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here's the Messiah,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will rise up and show great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the chosen. See, I've told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he's in the wilderness,' do not go out. Look, he's in the inner rooms. Do not believe it." Who's he talking to? His disciples who are waiting for him and longing for him and believing in him. "For just as lightning comes from the east and flashes as far as the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For wherever the carcass is, there the vultures will gather." So he's going to come with judgment. "But immediately after the trouble of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the land will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He will send out his angels with a great shofar, and they will gather together his chosen from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." So if you are a dispensationalist, if you believe in a pre-trib rapture, you say, this is referring to the second coming at the end of the age. But who's he been talking to? He's been talking to his followers this whole way through, his people, believers, the whole way through. It hasn't changed. All right, that's who he's been talking to. But let's just keep reading. "Now, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch becomes tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the door. Amen, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things happen." Again, we can debate the meaning of that. First temple destruction, to those who see this at the end. Second temple destruction, or destruction at the end of the age. Either way, I should say destruction of the second temple in Jesus' day, generation after that, or destruction of a what would be a third temple at the end of the age. A temple hasn't been built yet. Okay, we can debate all that, but who's he? You. Who's he speaking to? His disciples. It hasn't changed. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. But of that day, an hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, except the Father alone. What day? He's just referred to his coming as a post-tribulational coming, and says no one knows that day or hour, all right? He's been speaking to his disciples, his people, the body, the whole time. For just as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and swept them all away. So shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. Now, he's referred to his coming very clearly, a public coming, a public event, all right, the sign of his coming. He's referred to it. Now he's referring to it again. Which coming? The one coming. They did not understand until the flood came, swept them all away. So shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. Wait, we're told that's the rapture. This is a secret thing. This is going to be sudden and pull everyone out. But hang on. The coming that he spoke of is the coming of the Son of Man, his second coming after the tribulation of those days. That's what he's referring to. And no one knows that day or hour. All right. So you'll have the signs of what's happening, but no one knows the exact day or hour. And who's he talking to the whole way? His disciples. You say, no, this is about the rapture. Well, where did he change audiences? And I thought the rapture was for a different group of people, the church. And then the second coming, that had to do with Israel. And yet he's talking to believers the whole way through. Unless you're saying that the first Jewish believers weren't part of the church. And Peter and John weren't part of the church. Would you actually argue that? Then two men will be in the field, one taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one taken and one left. Therefore, stay alert, for you do not know what day your Lord is coming. He just referred to his coming after the tribulation and saying you don't know the day or the hour. He's referring to that coming. Now he's saying to the same people, the audience hasn't changed. It's not two separate audiences. You can't read the text like that. You have to read something in that doesn't exist. These are not two separate audiences and two separate events. This is one event, the coming of the Son of Man, the coming of Jesus at the end of the age. We're caught up to meet him. Therefore, stay alert, for you do not know what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what time the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and not let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready. You, the same ones I've been speaking to the whole time. For the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. One audience, one coming, one return. It's clear. It's clear. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm going to take a few calls, and then I want to get back to looking at some things happening in the world today. But first, we go to the phones. We start with Paul in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Brown.
You're welcome.
My question is, just in the mind of the average ancient Jew regarding the Messiah, how widespread and what was the level of anticipation of a coming Messiah? Like, if I were to ask a average Jew during that day about the Messiah, would that be very pronounced in their mind?
When you say that day, when are you referring to when you say ancient? Do you mean around the time of Jesus?
The day that the Messiah would actually come to Israel, where Israel would, you know, recognize that, oh, the Messiah has finally come. Was it pronounced? Okay.
Right. So if you want to go back to the time of Jesus, there were many Jews for whom this was something passionate and that they were looking for and expecting and believing that the Messiah would come and deliver them from the subjugation of Rome. But there were many others for whom it was absolutely not central or even a belief at all. In other words, there was a lot of variation in the ancient Jewish world. You had different Jewish sects. You had some that just were looking for a political solution fighting against Rome. Others that just thought we continue to observe the Torah and that's our responsibility. Others that were longing for the coming of redemption. If I ask you today, Paul, what's your average Christian think about the second coming of Jesus? Well, do I mean a born-again believing Christian? Do I mean a nominal Christian? And then which born-again believing Christian? There are different groups. Some don't even think about it. Some hardly believe in it. Some are passionately expecting it. It would have been very similar, sir, in the ancient world. So when you have, for example, a Simeon in Luke, the second chapter, who's been earnestly waiting for the consolation of Israel, that was not the normal person. I would say that may have been more of a remnant that had that fervent expectation. So if that would have been the innermost circle, then a little larger circle around that was praying for redemption and coming of Messiah, and others for whom it was not a fixed and pronounced and strong issue. As Jewish suffering rose, as the temple was destroyed, as Jewish people went into exile on a larger scale, then it became more of a national hope and national desire. But it was certainly a strong expectation and desire and focus among some, but I would not say among the Jewish people as a whole back 2,000 years. And by the way, there's a lot of scholarly debate about that, exactly how much Messiah was a topic of interest and concern for the Jewish people as a whole in that day. Hey, thank you for asking, sir. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Joel in California. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how you doing?
Doing very well, thank you.
Wonderful. Hey, I'm a pastor. I'm on part 10 of a series.
Uh-huh.
Which has been, should we follow the Sinai Covenant? And a lot of it has just been how Jesus fulfilled all these things.
Got it.
But we're finally getting into clear New Testament scriptures that demonstrate. So with that in mind, I'm looking at Acts 15,
mm-hmm.
and I totally understand the prohibition against separating yourself from food sacrificed to idols. I get that, and it even makes sense in light of, you know, Paul's stuff in Romans 14 and then Corinthians as well. And I also understand the final one, sexual immorality, but I feel like I'm missing something about the culture or context of drinking blood. Is drinking blood in and of itself a sinful, immoral thing? Or is it talking about, I read in like the Targum that it might be indicating for the prohibition against Noah back then was that it's actually like eating the animal while it's alive and biting into it and having that blood.
Right.
And then the other one, of course, strangling the animal, I would assume, is the same thing because they didn't butcher it. All the blood is inside of it. So am I kind of on
right.
track there?
Yeah. So it goes back to Genesis 9. There's a debate about porneia there. Does it mean sexual immorality in general, or does it specifically mean incest, which would have been widely practiced by the Gentiles and something that they needed to know right up front, or porneia, sexual immorality in the broadest sense? There's debate about that. But otherwise, we understand that there were certain laws that were given to Noah in Genesis, the 9th chapter, that were to be universal in scope. In other words, this is for all mankind, for all time. And then this ultimately develops into what's called the seven laws of Noah. And did the seven laws exist right at that point or not? That's debatable. But certainly some of them were clearly understood and followed. And the concept was that if you were a God-fearing Gentile, you didn't convert to Judaism, but you were a God-fearing Gentile. I'm sure you've read this as well. If you were a God-fearing Gentile, there would be certain things that you would not do. For example, blasphemy was forbidden, or murder was forbidden. And then some of these dietary laws were also forbidden. So there were these basic prohibitions and the call to establish courts of justice that the later rabbis deduced from Genesis 9. You have to do a little you know, exegetical gymnastics to pull them all from Genesis 9. But this is basically just telling the Gentile converts, okay, you don't have to become Jews. You don't have to come under the Sinai covenant. You don't have to become Jews. But here's some basic things that even a God-fearing Gentile would live by, and we're asking you to abide by these as well. The difference is that in the past, a God-fearing Gentile did not have the same status as a Jew, as a full convert. Here they're saying you have the same status. We are now equals in the Lord with equal access to the Father, equally loved by God, equally sons and daughters of God, except we're keeping these commandments as Jews, but as Gentiles, you don't have to. We're just asking you to abide by these basic Gentile God-fearing rules that were handed on by way of Noah. And that's the concept behind it. As for the blood, we understand in principle that nothing that you eat can spiritually defile you, right? Why? Because right. Matthew 15, Mark 7, it goes in your system and passes out, whereas it's what comes out of your heart that defiles you. It doesn't mean it's not wrong to do certain things. And the prohibitions with blood have to do with this recognizing the sacredness of blood. So let's say, for example, you saw something that was unclean, defiling some image. So, Lord, wash me clean. You know, I turn away from that. Help me to get that thing out of my mind. That's one thing. If you realize, you know, I just drank something, and now I find out that the native people where I am, they put blood in there. It's a different thing, Lord. I didn't mean to do that. But you didn't actually defile yourself spiritually in the process. It's just we want to recognize the sacredness of blood, and that's part of the reason for these prohibitions. The blood is the life, etc. And that's what's behind it. But Genesis 9 and then what becomes the seven laws of Noah, that's the real background there for Acts chapter 15.
Got it. And so
all right.
Also,
yeah, go ahead.
I've also kind of heard like that possibly the drinking of blood and strangling an animal were things also practiced in an idol temple, where like those first three prohibitions are all relating to within a temple. Like they would also drink blood in the temple and also strangle the animal in the temple, you know, like in a false god's temple. So I didn't know if there was any truth to that, and I was researching it, and I couldn't really find
it. Where did you find the references for that, just out of curiosity?
It was just, you know, somebody writing about it, and I'm like, okay, well, show me. Where did you get this from? And I couldn't find anything.
They didn't have sources for it. That's the key thing, right?
Right, correct.
Yep. Yeah, and just I just flipped open Craig Keener's Bible Background Commentary to the New Testament, and he notes that ethnic Gentiles should be called brothers and sisters is significant. And he says, when views were disputed later in academies, the majority view always prevailed. Here, he goes on how they came to their decisions. And hang on, let me just get the exact verses in question. Verses 19 and 20, the few requirements James suggests they impose are representative of the handful of laws Jewish tradition declared that God gave Noah. According to the more lenient Jewish position, any righteous Gentiles who kept those basic laws would have a share in the world to come. Because even stricter Pharisees had to get along with the majority of more lenient people, these teachers did not try to invalidate other teachers' rulings if they had majority consent. But again, it just goes back to the laws that Jewish tradition declared that God gave Noah, and this would have been what God-fearing Gentiles were expected to do. As for the other point, if it existed, Joel, I'm not aware of it either. When people don't give their sources, you always have to question it. When the source is another book, and you have to go to that book to find what the source is, you want to go to the primary sources. Where does this come from in the ancient world? Well, I heard someone said, but where does it actually come from? All right. So thank you, sir, for your questions and your good research. 866-34-TRUTH. When we come back, I'm going to give you an update on the Israeli elections, take more of your calls, and then just let you know how much virulent, ugly, blatant, unapologetic, outright anti-Semitism is out there. Can you criticize Jewish people without being anti-Semitic? Absolutely. Can you criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic? Absolutely. And is there something called anti-Semitic? Absolutely. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you've got a Jewish-related question, by all means, call 866-34-TRUTH. Our dear friend and colleague, Shira Sorkelram, she and her husband, Ari, lived in Israel for, 40 years now? And led ministry, the ministry Ma'oz, for many years. Shira has a great article on the Israeli elections. And I want to share this with you. I couldn't have said it better than Shira did. So let me share this with you, all of you watching and listening. I think this will be helpful to you. She said, we're electing a prime minister on April 9th. Our current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was recently indicted for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, allegedly offering favors in order to get good news coverage for himself and bad coverage for his political opponents. He is said to have received hundreds of thousands of shekels in cigars and champagne in exchange for giving friends and relatives business benefits. However, conviction is many months away and not at all assured. Netanyahu's present coalition is made up of mainly Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox parties. These conservatives believe Judea and Samaria is promised to the Jewish people, called the West Bank by others, and so they will not accept a Palestinian state on central Israel's doorstep. Unfortunately, they're also very anti-Messianic, meaning anti-Messianic Jew, and spend much time and tax money harassing Jewish believers in their businesses, and especially working to deny believers the right to immigrate to Israel. All Jews in the world have automatic rights to immigrate and receive Israeli citizenship, except those who believe in Yeshua. The ultra-Orthodox, which now number about 1 million Israelis, constantly drag the Israeli economy down by extracting huge amounts of tax money in exchange for their partnership with Netanyahu's coalition. They use the funds to pay themselves stipends, as only about 50% of Orthodox men work and the rest spend a lifetime studying rabbinical literature in their yeshivas, and their population continues to grow. Most Israelis understandably feel very negative about the Orthodox appropriating such vast sums of money. On the other hand, Israelis admit there is no one like Netanyahu with his brilliant handling of the world outside of the country. Who doesn't know we certainly have enemies in every direction, yet Netanyahu has done wonders. It would appear to me that most likely Netanyahu's type of corruption is unfortunately common among politicians in general here. All want good media coverage, all would like to do favors for friends, etc. But the press leans to the left, the media to the far left, so no sin of Netanyahu is left uncovered. Quite a lot of citizens are simply tired of hearing, about this corruption in the media day after day. From the party center left, we have General Benny Gantz, who is well-liked, well-respected, and fresh out of the army. In fact, Israelis have strong faith in the values and honesty of the IDF, Israeli Defense Force. Gantz has joined together with a well-known center-left ex-journalist, Yair Lapid, to create the Blue and White Party. No one knows exactly what Gantz stands for, but he is hinting that he would not be interested in creating a Palestinian state. The normal left in Israel is nowhere near the left's extreme dogma of the U.S. or Europe. The blue and white would most likely give more religious freedom to non-Orthodox citizens like Messianic Jews. In fact, the Orthodox hate Yair Lapid because of his anti-Orthodox stance. And believe it or not, both of these men are considered clean and honest. But Gantz, as a politician, is an unknown. Meanwhile, the mountain of challenges in Israel knows no end. How to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon with which they have promised to wipe out Israel? How to deal with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, both of whose goals are to replace the state of Israel? How to deal with the rising anti-Semitism in Europe, especially France. Already 55,000 Jews have left France for Israel, and the Jewish state is preparing to receive another 200,000. How to deal with potentially difficult demands that might appear in President Trump's peace plan, which has not yet been revealed. How to stay prepared in case Hezbollah decides it's time for another war. How to further the United States' decision to recognize the Golan Heights and get other nations recognize them as belonging to Israel, part of Israel's inheritance according to the Torah. How to bring more Arab and African nations to recognize Israel as a legitimate state. Perhaps the biggest of all challenges is just about what Israel should do about Judea and Samaria. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas is 82 and ill. No one knows what will happen, except that if an actual election is held in the West Bank, the chances are huge that Hamas will win as they did in Gaza. After 70 years of no from the Palestinians, few Israelis have the stomach to see Gaza too rise up a few miles from Tel Aviv, Haifa, and inside Jerusalem. The Ben-Gurion National Airport would become an easy missile target. Our focus, she writes, is on the promises of God that he will bring our Jewish people back to himself and give them a new heart and a new spirit. And at the right time, God will also give us back all the land he promised us some 4,000 years ago. The two main parties are now neck and neck in the polls. Lord, your will be done in Israel as it is in heaven. Yeah, that's the only way I know how to pray. God, your will be done. You alone know what is best for Israel. You alone know what is best for the Jewish people, for the surrounding nations, for the Palestinians, for the world. Your will be done, Father, in the elections. Sometimes God's will is to bring a humbling on a nation. Sometimes God's will is to raise up a nation. Sometimes God's purposes are different than what we expect. Sometimes God is looking 100 miles down the line and we're only looking 6 inches down the line. So God, your will be done. The stakes are very high. All right, we are about to go back to the phones. But first, let me just mention this. I took exception to many, many extreme comments made by comedian Owen Benjamin about the Jewish people. I took issue with them on a video, played some clips, and by all means, yeah, we've copied him on different things. Of course, I'd love to interact anytime. I didn't know who he was until just a few weeks back. And we've invited, or we're in the process, I don't want to misrepresent, I don't know if we've reached him yet, but in the process of inviting E. Michael Jones, a Catholic scholar who I believe holds to anti-Semitic views, and he would say he's absolutely not anti-Semitic, but he's interacted with Owen Benjamin. We want to have him on the air so he and I can have a candid, open conversation. So we want to do that. All I want to say right now is this. For those who just want a taste of the ugliness that's out there the moment you call out anti-Semitism, here's a quick sampling. I can give you hundreds of examples like this, and the most vile we can't read or even post. There's too much junk in them. But this is just a little sampling from maybe the last 8 hours, last 12 hours. Most of the comments we left on, a few may have been so crazy we took off. The YouTube, our YouTube channel, where I respond to some of Owen Benjamin's anti-Semitic comments. But here are just a few. Look at the sunken pits under the eyes. Ask Dr. Brown is infested with devils and profanes the mustache. Oh, yeah, this is a flood of junk like this. How about this? Any Jewish person in history who seriously accepted Jesus as the Messiah totally rejected the Talmud. You are a crypto-Jew, not a messianic one. So the fact that I've spent 47 years sharing the good news of Jesus with my people, the fact that I couldn't emigrate to Israel now because I'm too well-known as a Jewish believer in Jesus, the fact that I've been overseas almost 200 times sharing the gospel around the world and have devoted myself to preaching Jesus and lifting him up. Because when the Talmud is misrepresented, I explain what it really says because this stuff has been used by Jew haters for the centuries. That means I'm not a true believer in Jesus. I'm a crypto Jew. What are people thinking? Read volume 5 of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, where the whole volume is taking issue with the Talmud. But when it's misrepresented and libeled, I'm going to speak the truth about it and set the record straight because I've seen Jew haters use this stuff for centuries. Oh, and by the way, plenty of prominent Jewish believers like Alfred Edelman and many others, while not coming under Talmudic authority anymore, Jewish Christians, Jewish believers in Jesus, they often cited Talmud rabbinic literature and appreciated much of it and differed with much of it as well. How about this? Anti-Semite is a meaningless word. The channel, meaning our YouTube channel, is taking things out of context. The same way Jews complain about people taking passages from the Talmud out of context. Actually, we only address the comments when one of our team members who had listened to a lot of Owen Benjamin, a lot, began to send me clips and then assured me everything's in context and then just sent me whole YouTube sections to look at where I looked at the whole thing. This is the whole thing posted. And it's anti-Semitic. That's what it is. You say, well, a Semite, have to be a Semite. It is anti-Semitism means Jew hatred. That's what it means. Okay? You can criticize Jews without being an anti-Semite. All right? There's plenty to criticize about Jews and plenty to praise about Jews. You can criticize Israel without being an anti-Semite. And you can be an anti-Semite. There are certain lines that get crossed where you demonize Jewish people as a whole and speak in sweeping terms and repeat certain standard anti-Semitic laws, and we call it out as anti-Semitism. He doesn't mean all Jews, man. They're fake Jews. Ah, so the Jews he's attacking, meaning the Jews all around the world, they're not really Jews. That's another anti-Semitic lie. These oppressive criminals hide behind the tailment. They claim they are Jews but are not. How about you debate Owen Benjamin instead of just assuming he's against the Jews as all? Gladly debate, dialogue, anything, interact, anytime. There's a difference between real Jews and fake Jews. The Bible clearly talks of the fake Jews being from the synagogue of Satan, does it not? The Talmud is evil. Under the Noahide laws of the Talmud, Christians can be put to death for worshiping Jesus, which is breaking their first commandment. Change my mind. Okay, please show me in the Talmud, in context, rightly understood, where it says that Christians should be put to death for worshiping Jesus. Please show me, okay? Why should I change your mind when you're quoting falsehood? First, provide the reference, okay? And then we'll explain what the reference actually says. Is the Talmud against Jesus? Sure, it's not a major topic in the Talmud. Is the Talmud against Jesus? Yes, that's because the people involved with it were not believers in Jesus and were lost in terms of their salvation. That's why I pray for Jewish people to be saved and share the gospel with Jewish people. That's why I'm hated by some Jews. I've been called public enemy number one because we've been successful in reaching Jewish people with the gospel. That's reality. Here, someone else. Michael is a Jewish follower of Jesus, just like I'm a Christian follower of Islam. Actually, Paul was a Jewish follower of Jesus, as was John, as was Peter, as have been many Jews through the ages. It is one thing to practice Judaism in a traditional way. It's another thing to be Jewish. It can mean a practitioner of Judaism, or it can mean someone who is descendant of the people of Israel. And Paul talks about himself, doesn't he? Paul talks about himself as being from the line of Benjamin, circumcised on the eighth day. He says, I don't boast in this, but this is who I am. And go through this whole thing of fake Jews. Go through the New Testament. Look up every single time the word Jew occurs. You'll see it always refers to Jewish people. And then there are two references in Revelation 2 and Revelation 3 about Jews who claimed to be Jews and they weren't, but they were opposing the gospel. Maybe they were Gentiles. Maybe they weren't Jews at all. Maybe they claimed to be Jews and they weren't. Or in a spiritual sense, they weren't living as Jews should because they opposed the gospel. But go through the New Testament when it speaks of Jews, 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 Israel, Israel, Israel. Paul explicitly says the covenants remain theirs and God's love is still set on them and will save them. By the way, a ton more comments, just couldn't get to them. Your call's next.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. On the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. By the way, I posted a very important article this morning, fined $55,000 for calling a male on stream.org. It's been shared about 10,000 times since mid-morning today. You can read it on our website, AskDrBrown.org. You'll also enjoy last night's Real Messiah broadcast. We got into some really interesting discussion about various messianic prophecies. So check that out all on our website, AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org. All right, let us go to Hubert in Florida. Thanks for holding. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello. Are you hearing me?
Yes, I am. Go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to know what you think about Acts of the Apostles, chapter 8, verse 2.
All right, and what in particular were you wondering about?
I wanted to know do you think Luke was the writer of Acts?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to know what he meant when he wrote that devout people buried Stephen. Is that correct?
Yes. Devout men buried him. And he was highly respected. And these were devout Jews who buried him and made great lamentation over him. Yes.
And do you know who those Jews were?
Nope.
You don't know.
Don't know.
Did you think the writer knew? Do you think that Luke knew who those Jews were?
Could be. He may have known them by name or just in general.
So why didn't he name them?
Well, number one, it's all speculation. We don't know. Maybe he didn't know. Number two, he doesn't name every person that's ever involved with everything. So you must have a reason for asking this, sir. What's your angle?
My angle is that the person that buried Stephen was Gamaliel and Nicodemus.
Where do you get that from?
You get that from the burial of Stephen. They know they have Stephen's body.
But where do you...
Stephen's body was...
Right, but why in the world would you say that it's Gamaliel and Nicodemus? Where are you getting that from?
Because they're the ones that he was buried with.
How do you know that?
The ones who buried him.
Who told you that, sir? Excuse me?
Just read about... Don't you know that they recovered Stephen's body?
No, they did not. Who recovered Stephen's body?
Stephen's body was recovered in 415 A.D.
Okay. And
it was stated there that Nicodemus was the one who buried him.
Right. All you have, sir, is traditions from hundreds of years later. You know how many wild traditions there are?
I'm not talking about traditions. They have the body of Gamaliel, they have the body of Nicodemus, and they have the body of
Jesus. Who's they?
The Catholic Church.
All right, it's pure tradition, sir. The Catholic Church does not have the body of Gamaliel, a Jewish leader. It's pure tradition. It's all it is. It's tradition. I appreciate you believing it and being zealous about it, but it's pure tradition. And tell you what, and thank you for calling, sir. I appreciate it. Kai, just do a search on if the Catholic Church has the body of Gamaliel, and let's just see what comes up there. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Greg in Cary, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you. I have a question about were incidents of where Peter and Paul both prayed for the healing separate cases, but it tells in the Bible about where they fastened their eyes on the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious what the significance was, because I know that the Bible wouldn't just say that without it being any kind of significance to it. And I just never heard anybody say the significance of that. And I was just, it's kind of always stuck in my craw, not really stuck, you know what I mean? It's just, it's always been a wonder of mine.
Yeah, to me, it's just intense focus. That you're preaching to someone and you sense faith or you feel faith in your heart and you're focused on that person. It's not like there's magic in your eyes or healing in your eyes, right?
Right.
Look at me. Listen to what I'm telling you. Listen to me right now. And they're locked in on him and that person is locked in on them. And now get up. That's just how I see it. It's like a miracle's about to happen. Look at me. Listen to me. All right, and now you speak with faith. Sure, that's how I see it. I don't see anything more. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, can I ask you one more real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Gamaliel.
Yep.
Is Gamaliel the same one that is it Gamaliel that he may be talking about? The same one that taught Paul.
Yeah, that's who he's talking about. In he's mentioned in the fifth chapter of Acts, and then Paul references sitting at his feet. But yeah, according to that's the claim there. And just while we were doing this, I typed in who buried Stephen. So here's a Catholic website, the finding of the relics of St. Stephen, the first martyr. Again, it's all that Gamaliel appeared to this holy man in his sleep and disclosed to where the bodies of St. Stephen's, Nicodemus, his son, Abba. So it's all Catholic tradition and myth. That's all that is there. Hey, but thanks for your question. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Russell in Georgia. Let's go to Jeff in Oklahoma. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hey, I had a couple questions related to the 70th week of Daniel, and more specifically the Abomination of Desolation event.
Yep.
And do you think that that has already been fulfilled and happened in the past? And then my second question is the man of sin, the lawless one, the Antichrist, that it talks about in 2 Thessalonians, and then also I think Revelation 13. Do you think that is part of the 70th week abomination event? Is it separate? And then also, should we expect another temple in the future to be built?
So,
because it talks about him going into the temple in Thessalonians.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So I see abomination of desolation, which is mentioned several times in Daniel. We think of it in the 9th chapter, the 27th verse, but mentioned a few other times in Daniel as well. The first referent to that would have been the desecrating of the temple with Antiochus Epiphanes about 160 years before the time of Jesus. When Jesus makes reference to it now, again, you realize, okay, there's more going on. I don't believe Daniel 9:27 referred to that event, but other places in Daniel, I believe it was referring to that first. He's saying, no, there's something else. So yes, it took place in the time of the destruction of the temple in the year 70. Yes, that happened. However, I do believe there will be a third temple that is built. I do believe that there will be a parallel, almost like a recapitulation of Matthew 24 again at the end of the age. Just as many of the passages about the return of the Jews from exile had a partial fulfillment and then the rest to come, kind of a final repeat later on. So I do believe, I'm not dogmatic on it, but I do believe that there will be a third temple and that there will be something similar, a similar type of abomination of desolation, a similar attack on Jerusalem at the end of the age. We see that also in Zechariah 12 and Zechariah 14, and that God will then come and deliver his people and Israel will repent and turn to him at that time. That being said, my view is that Daniel 9:24-27, the 70 weeks of Daniel, are fulfilled in terms of the fundamental teaching there that this had to do with Jesus dying for our sins, rising from the dead, bringing us atonement, bringing us redemption. He had to do that before the second temple was destroyed. If there is kind of like an echo of Daniel 9:27 at the end of the age, fine. But I believe the 70 weeks of Daniel happened basically in a consecutive manner with very small gaps between them, and with the destruction of the second temple in the year 70, and that there will be, yes, so Matthew 24, that's where I'm looking at it primarily, Matthew 24, that there's something still forward that we're looking to some, excuse me, event, some type of recapitulation. So in that sense, you could say it's fulfilled, but in a sense, yet future. I don't have a problem with that the 70 weeks of Daniel were fulfilled, but there's yet a future final fulfillment of it. That doesn't trouble me. But for sure, they did apply to the generation of Jesus, those that he warned, those that saw those things happen. For sure, they applied to them. And I do believe there'll be a final application at the end of the age as well. And our focus, though, in the midst of all this, and I'm sure you'd agree, Jeff, is making Jesus known, proclaiming Yeshua as the Savior of Jew and Gentile alike, making him known to the ends of the earth, and working towards longing for his glorious appearing and his return to this earth. Hey, friends, if you appreciate what we're doing, pray for us. Share these broadcasts with a friend. It's a great way to help get the message out. Stand with us financially to help us reach more Jewish people with the good news of Jesus. Back with you tomorrow with your questions.